Hello, everybody, and welcome to Frontside Podcast, episode 83. My name is Charles Lowell, developer here at the Frontside and your podcast host in training. With me today on the podcast is Elric also. Hello, Elric.
Hello, how you doing?
I'm doing well. I'm glad to have you on this one. I'm glad to be doing this podcast in general. We have someone on the podcast today who I've been following for, I guess, probably about 2 years because she published a book that has been very, very helpful to me. And it's one that I recommend to a lot of people. It is Learning Haskell from First Principles. So with us on the show is Julie Morinucci, who is a co-author of that book. So thank you so much, Julie,
hi.
For coming.
Happy to be here.
Yeah.
It's nice to finally get to talk to you. Yeah.
One of the reasons I wanted to have you on the podcast was because I feel as though you have kind of one of the most unique origin stories to programming and entering in the tech world. You know, most of us are kind of, we're curious. We either come from video games or maybe we just start fiddling with the web browser. You know, you kind of entered the maze from an entrance that, you know, is like hidden from all. I would say you went straight to writing a book on Haskell. Is that...
That is what happened, yes. So, yeah, in 2014 on Twitter, I met my co-author, Chris Allen, and he was interested. He's been trying to figure out better ways to teach people Haskell because the kind of on-ramping, I guess, people to Haskell can be quite difficult. The materials that exist are not always accessible, and people felt, you know, like they need advanced math degrees before they can write Haskell. So, he was trying to figure out better ways to introduce people to it. And so since I was this person who's never programmed before, so I have no background in it, he thought, well, this will be a very different experience trying to teach Haskell to her. And then I also, because I have a linguistics background and stuff, he thought, well, you know, that would be interesting too. And maybe, you know, she'd be interested in eventually in doing NLP. And so I said, you know, I'm not.
What's an acronym alert?
Natural language processing.
Okay.
And I said, you know, I've never done any programming and I don't play video games and I never have had any desire to learn computer programming. And so, so I said, I don't think I'm going to like this. I don't think this is going to last, but I will. Okay, sure. I will try. So I did a little bit. I read, you know, a little bit of Learn You a Haskell for Great Good. I read some other things. And then
this was before you guys had the idea of actually writing a book. This is before this even happened. Okay.
Yeah. So it's kind of started. He had sort of the idea of turning some of his thoughts about teaching Haskell into a book. And, you know, as he would explain things to me, like questions I had about Learn You a Haskell, as he would explain them to me, I'd be like, we should write this down. And he would say, well, it's so hard to write it, though. It's easy when I'm explaining it to you, but it's so hard to write it. And so initially it started that I was kind of helping him edit, you know, things that he was teaching me. And then as we got further into the book and I started reading a lot of other Haskell stuff on my own and figuring stuff out, I was writing more and more of it. And so then we were, you know, kind of equal co-authors after not too long. So, yeah, so that's how it happened. I really didn't think that I would stick with Haskell or with programming. And I'm still sometimes I'm not sure about programming. I'm not sure about this whole making software thing. But Haskell is so interesting to me that I'm still sort of here.
Well, that is fantastic. And it's a great story. And I'm curious, you know, so when you were kind of doing the proto research to learning Haskell, you know, coming from really, truly first principles, having no experience with programming, what made a good resource, you know, versus a bad resource? Like, what were the things that you gravitated towards and say, oh, wow, this is really instructive? Like, what was the tone there?
So one of the major problems I had with most of the Haskell resources that exist is they assume that you've done programming before because nobody learns Haskell as a first language, right? Mm-hmm. So they all assume that you had done some programming before. So they would make references to things that you, if you were a programmer, you would know what they meant, but I didn't. And so that was one of the hardest things for me. And even Learn You a Haskell does that to some extent.
So what's an example of that?
Now, I had learned a little bit about recursion from linguistics because that's a thing in human language. So I already kind of understood recursion, but most of the Haskell resources explain it to you primarily in terms of, you know, well, this will be like your loops in other languages, right? And I'll be like, I don't know what a loop is. So this isn't helpful for me. And there were a lot of things like I didn't understand. So when people talk about Haskell as being, you know, it's a pure functional language, neither pure nor functional necessarily. I didn't have anything to contrast them with, so they didn't necessarily make sense to me as things that make Haskell different from other languages. I didn't know what imperative programming was, and people would say, well, in contrast to imperative programming, functional programming does this, and I'd be like, okay, but I don't understand what the imperative programming way is, so this contrast isn't making any sense to me. And same thing with purity. And so there were a lot of things I had to learn, in fact, about mutable state because I didn't know, you know, anything about it. I mean, I had some understanding of how, you know, computer memory works. So, but still some of the ways that people talk about it were not obvious to me. So
do you find that seeking out that contrast actually, was it helpful? Is it noise since, you know, at least at the beginning, it's something you'll never do. You know, it's kind of like saying, well, over in France, they wear these kind of socks. That's not really, since I'm going out under the street in front of my house, I don't really care.
Right. Yeah. In the beginning, it was a lot of noise. And I understand why they do that, because they are making the assumption that, you know, everybody who's learning Haskell has come from some other programming language, probably an imperative one. So I understand why that happens. But in the beginning, it was very much noise for me. Like, I noticed a lot of Haskell resources, one of the first things they tell you is that, well, in Haskell, you can't do X equals X plus one, right? And I was like, well, if I'm reading this like it's mathematics, why would I think I could do that?
Right.
Because, well, if you come from a different programming language, you might well think that you can do that. But in Haskell, we can't. And so making that contrast when I didn't have that background was really just confusing for me. Now, because I teach people and most of them do have some background in, you know, an imperative language, now understanding the contrast is more helpful to me. But in the beginning, it was just confusing and noise. So we tried, when we wrote Haskell book, we tried not to make those kinds of references and just assume, like, let's assume that everybody is just like Julie, doesn't know a different programming language that we can contrast it with. Right. And let's try to write a book like that. So.
Right. I think that's a key insight, because, you know, some people might say there's a lot missing, or that difference might stand out. You know, now that you point it out, I can see it. I don't think I noticed it while I was reading it. But one of the things that I like is, because I also tried to learn Haskell through the Learn You Haskell through Great Good. Mm-hmm. And I didn't find it very helpful. I found it entertaining.
Yeah.
And it's not a knock against the author. Some of the sketches were really cute, but it was still kind of more explaining. I don't know. It was explaining more of the how than the why, if that makes any sense. Whereas, you know, I felt as though, you know, in your book, there were a lot more analogies to actual, you know, human experiences, using kind of the visceral language, saying, you know, a monoid is something that you can mash together or like squeeze together. You know, that really connected for me, whereas like explaining it in terms of concatenation and laws and stuff like that.
Right.
Those things seem like the secondary resource instead of the primary resource.
Right. Yeah, I think that's kind of how it felt for me too. There are different Haskell books that have, I think, different things about them that are good. Like, I forget the name of the book, but Graham Hutton's book, the way he talks about recursion was really helpful to me, the way he explains recursion. And of course, folds, but he's, you know, folds are one of his sort of things that he's known for. And so those parts of that book were helpful for me. But really the best book, other than my own, of course, the best book for me was... Simon Thompson's, I think it's called The Craft of Functional Programming. And I think it does better at explaining things in terms of Haskell, instead of like trying to make it seem like real world Haskell, I guess is really good. It was harder for me because I hadn't been a programmer before. Like, I think it's got so many practical exercises that.
Was that the O'Reilly book by the Irish gentleman whose name eludes me?
Yes. Brian O'Sullivan.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it makes more sense to me now, but there were things in it that are sort of programmer things that I, you know, because I'd never made software before, that were really confusing for me. But Simon Thompson's was the one that really, his exercises, I thought, because his book does have exercises, and they were ones that like I could understand and do. They were fairly self-contained. And so my first experience actually writing a program that does IO, right, it was from his book, and I was just so thrilled. I was like, I got it. I did it. That was a really helpful book for me, but it's one of the, like, I don't see people recommend that one as often, but that was probably the best one for me.
Yeah, it's always a balance because the real world Haskell didn't really work for me almost because the examples were too pragmatic or too complex.
Yeah.
Like I remember there was one that was, you know, and this is I picked this up when I was 10 years into my programming career and I struggled to follow the JSON parser example, for right. which is, you know, something yeah. that, you know, and parsing JSON is something that I'd actually done several times in other, you know, in multiple languages. And I still struggled with it.
Whereas for me, I was like coming to that and I don't even know what JSON is, right? This is not something I've ever dealt with. And I mean, I know what it is now, well, sort of, but it's still not something that I deal with very much because, right. You know, and so I was just like, what even is this? I don't even know what to do here. So yeah, it wasn't quite as helpful for me as it, you know, I've heard a lot of people have success with that one, but I think that if you don't share quite the same richness of programming experience with Brian O'Sullivan, I think it's a little bit more difficult. So mm-hmm. yeah. Mm-hmm.
These are a lot of amazing resources that I wish I knew about when I tried to learn Haskell. I took a online course with, I think, is like Eric Major?
Oh, Eric Meyer.
Mm-hmm. Eric Meyer. And that class was very intense.
Yeah. And
looking back, what would you say are some areas that someone should either start to look into before they step into the Haskell world, being that you didn't come from a programming background, but like connecting mm-hmm. the dots backwards now? What would you say are some areas that, you know, people can slowly ramp up into to get into Haskell and functional programming?
So the easiest, like when I teach people Haskell, the people who have the easiest time are people who have been writing Scala for a while and they've moved over to the sort of FP and Scala side. You know, I've heard people, when I first started Haskell, I heard a lot of people make jokes about how Scala is a gateway drug to Haskell. And I think there's actually might be some truth in that because I certainly have a lot of students, they were Java programmers. Then they got interested in Scala because maybe Scala is better for some things, you know, than Java. And then they start moving more and more over to the FP and Scala side. And so those are probably the students that have, I think, the easiest time making the transition to Haskell that I've had mm-hmm. anyway. But, you know, I think there's a lot of things that, so trying to write even JavaScript, trying to write it in a more functional style. And there are mm-hmm. some, you know, there are some resources for that. And really there's a very good tutorial about monads that uses all the code examples are in JavaScript. So I think a lot of the concepts that you can start to approach them from other languages, Haskell is still going to be weird in a lot of ways. And another thing that works for a lot of people is going to Elm. Elm is similar to Haskell, but different and I think that has worked also for a lot of people, getting them into understanding, you know, more functional programming concepts, but with a much easier, you know, the word easy is so.
It's like a relative term. It's like, oh yeah, this is
it
easy.
Is.
That's
it
easy to say, right?
That's what I thought when I stepped into like learning Haskell and functional programming. I was like, oh, how bad could it be?
Right. Learning Haskell can be very bad. I'm not gonna kid around about that. It's a shame because I don't think that it needs to be that bad, but the way it's presented oftentimes for various reasons. I mean, I think there are various cultural reasons why Haskell gets presented the way it does, but I don't think it needs to happen like that. But you know, the designer of Elm, whose name I'm not going to try to pronounce because I don't know how you say his last name, but you know, he really made an effort to make like the error messages, for example. The error messages in Haskell can be very intimidating. The situation there has improved since I started learning Haskell, but they can be quite intimidating. And he really made an effort to make very friendly error messages, very helpful error messages. And I think that it shows and that it makes a difference for people who are learning. And so then, you know, if you start with Elm and then you do want to see then what Haskell or, you know, PureScript, which is also a front end language mostly, it's compiled to JavaScript, but it's very Haskell-like. And so then you want to get more into from Elm, you want to get, you know, well, let's see if we can get a little more hardcore Haskell, right? Then I think the transition to Haskell or PureScript is easier from there. So just sort of moving, I think it does help to move in the functional direction from whatever language you're in. If you do FP and Scala, try moving to more functional JavaScript or even to Elm. And then, you know, Haskell will make, I think, more sense from there or be a little easier to approach.
Yeah. And I definitely think that, you know, for at least from my perspective, you know, I've been able to take a lot of those concepts that I've learned from Haskell and then apply them even, you know, even inside just vanilla JavaScript. You know, there, mm-hmm. there are things that are, have become like indispensable, like mapping and, okay. you know, and folding. I mean, these things are so, but, and they exist in JavaScript, but really, so you have, you know, you can reduce arrays, which is similar to a fold, and you can map arrays, but understanding that map, see the key insight for me, and from that I got from learning Haskell is that there's a whole class of values, you know, that you can map, not just arrays. You
right.
know, you can, mm-hmm. you know, the object, the standard JavaScript object is essentially a functor. And we'll get a little bit, because I, you know, for people listening, what that word even means and like the meta around the fact that there are all these weird words and how to like go about like, that's something I want to ask you about. But like, you know, the trees can be mapped and the objects can be mapped. And all of a sudden it's like this one concept that I use so much for lists. What? It's available on all these different data structures. And it's getting me like thinking like, okay, what other data structures can I use this operation? What is also, you know, what other things are functors that I'm working with? And right. really it's changed my perspective to think about the type of the data structure in terms of the operations.
Like, I'm in favor of keeping the terminology that we have, but just explaining it much better, right? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the approach that I take. But it can be very hard when you're first, especially as you're first learning Haskell, or even just because you're really, I don't know if you've seen the Haskell pyramid, but to get sort of productive where you can write programs in Haskell is not a very high bar. It feels like it is when you first start, but it's not really very high bar. But Haskell's just sort of keeps growing and growing and getting deeper and deeper. And so you're always kind of like approaching new libraries that you've never seen before. And you feel then like learning Haskell all over again, because they're written in a very different style of Haskell, or they have even more terminology, even more kinds of functors that you've never heard of before or something like that. And so you're always sort of approaching these things over again. And it can be a very intimidating feeling, and it makes a lot of people very uncomfortable. And I'd say if you like Haskell and that does make you feel uncomfortable, then you don't actually need to do that, because a lot of people write Haskell very happily every day in their jobs even, and don't do that. They don't mess with some of the newer, super cool libraries that have all this, you know, funky terminology and stuff. Some of them just don't mess with it at all. So,
but certainly there is some, you know, there's some concepts that are core, you know, I'm thinking of like, you know, applicative and functor and, you know, all these things that I'm kind of like learning about. And I'm curious to hear about your experience, like as you climb that pyramid. I think that, so what is the pyramid entail? First of all, I'd love to hear more about it, because this is actually the first time I've heard about the Haskell pyramid.
Oh yeah. The Haskell pyramid is sort of, if you get to say where you understand monads, all right, then you can write really a lot of Haskell programs. Probably at some point you will need to understand monad transformers, but if you just get to the point where you understand monads pretty decently, you can write a lot of software. And so after that, then learning more is maybe going to improve your Haskell, maybe let you write some things that you couldn't write before. But a lot of it above, say, I mean, above, not that these things are necessarily, you know, in a hierarchical progression, but a lot of things that would go, you know, like we cover monad transformers in a fair bit of detail in Haskell book. But if you get anything beyond what's in Haskell book, you know, a lot of those things, some of them are very interesting. Some of them can make you much more productive, but some of them are also, people do them for fun to explore the space. And some people love them and some people, you know, hate them. And Haskell lets you do a lot of things for fun and exploring, you know, mathematics in ways that are interesting and exciting and may influence, and in fact have influenced, other languages like Idris and PureScript, but are not really necessary for, you know, sort of basic Haskell programming. So a nice thing happened while we were writing Haskell book, in that I was writing, I think it's chapter 6, I think, which is about type classes. I was writing that chapter, and at the same time, my co-author had started writing the monoid chapter. So the type classes chapter comes in chapter 6, and we introduce you know, a lot of the basic type classes, num and eek and ord, and, you know, some of those in that chapter, because I do think it's important. I mean, type classes are sort of a very special thing about Haskell, and so I think it's important to kind of at least start coming to grips with them early. Some people disagree with me about that and think you can ignore them for much longer. But at any rate, it is where it is. And I felt that that was important. But I didn't really understand, I think, maybe the real motivation for type classes really until we started writing the Monoid chapter. So he started writing that while I was working on the type classes chapter, and he sent me, you know, the beginnings of the Monoid chapter to look at. And I was just, at first I thought, well, okay, we've got, you know, addition and multiplication and list concatenation, and this just doesn't seem interesting. What am I supposed to get? What is this generalization of a monoid that I'm supposed to get from these three things, right? And why bother making it a type class? Because addition and multiplication are already in the num type class, and then list concatenation is just for lists. So why make this into a type class? And what's that motivation there, right? So with eek, right, we want a quality.
Is that how you pronounce eek?
That's how I pronounce it, because okay. Equal, right?
Equal.
Equality, okay. Right?
So this is a type class for doing what? Making sure that two things are being able to compare if two things, yeah. Two values are the same value.
Yes. And it's a weird one because you really want to have, I mean, for most data types, right, you can have an eek instance, right? And you want probably in a lot of cases to have that. But what we don't want, because function is a data type, right, in Haskell. And so you don't want to have an eek instance for functions. And that's why equality is not implemented generally for everything. Uh-huh. So that's why it's a type class. So there's no instance for functions because you can't, that's not decidable, right? You can't decide if two functions are equal generally. Some functions you can, but in the general terms for a data type, you can't.
Right.
Yeah. So
that's actually a pretty profound statement, proof of which is left as an exercise for the reader.
Yes, right.
For the listener.
And so, when we got to Monoid, and I was like, well, what is the point of nation or something? And well, it turns out that there are monoids everywhere. There's all kinds of things that you want to either concatenate or make a product of, right? Mm-hmm. So then having this as a type class and thinking of it in terms of like, okay, we've got this abstraction, we've got this category, right? We've got this algebraic structure that now we can look for in all these other places. Because yeah. it's like once you've named a thing, then you can talk about it and think about it in a little bit of a different way. It's like now it's not just, oh, we've got this group of addition, multiplication, list concatenation. Now we've got an abstraction of that and we can think, well, where else can I see this pattern, right? And it yeah. turns out it's just all over the place. And so for me, that was when I thought like, oh, wow, type classes are actually a really cool and kind of powerful and interesting thing. And so for me, that was when it seemed like, okay, the terminology is worth it because now I want right. to think about finding these algebraic structures in all these other places, right?
And it's like a monoid could essentially be called, like if you were using a Java interface, could be called like mashable togetherable right. or like, you know, concatenatable or something like that.
Right.
But the it's just a very like succinct, like, but there's a kind of a one-to-one correspondence, but it is mm-hmm. just, it is a vocabulary that just yes. needs to be learned.
I don't know much about, category theory or anything, but the other cool thing about monoid for me was that, you know, there are almost always two, because there's almost always one that's disjunctive or additive uh-huh. and or concatenative. And there's always almost always one that then is conjunctive or a product or multiplicative, right? It's often a cross product. Like with lists, it's the zip list, would be the zip list monoid. That instance uh-huh. doesn't like exist in base, but it would be. And it's a cross product of the two lists. And so there's almost always two. Whereas I think in like when you think of monoids in the very abstract, like in category theory, it doesn't matter if it's addition or multiplication, right? The operation doesn't matter whether it's addition or multiplication or concatenation or a cross product. It's because you've generalized the actual operation to the extent where what it's going to produce, it doesn't matter anymore, right? But like for me, I still think of monoids then in terms of more like sort of set theory or Boolean algebra. And then that's one of the things that I think is difficult with Haskell, where people talk about monoids in terms of category theory, but I think that that's not very helpful for the actual programmer who has to actually deal with like the two different instances. Like sum and product or concatenation mm-hmm. and zipping are going to actually act different in a program, right?
Right, right. They're going to yield a yeah. different set of values.
Yes. So, yeah.
So is there like a baseline vocabulary that like what's, you know, so, you know, I kind of think of it as like learning a new language, right?
Yeah.
You know, literally, like when you're learning Haskell, you're not just learning a new language. You're literally learning a new language.
You are literally learning a new language.
You know, I could go and I could learn Japanese, but there's it's going to be a struggle at some point. You know, people say certain languages are hard and certain languages are easy. I don't generally subscribe to that. I think that, you know, most of it is just going about and living in a place where they speak this language.
Yes.
And you and you will and you will absorb it. And it's the decision to go live there that's kind of the primary one.
But, exactly. Yeah.
But so let's say, you know, you're a foreigner and you're traveling, you know, to this country called Haskell that's got this strange language that's like other human languages. It's just got different names associated with different concepts. And some of the concepts might even just be unique to that country. Just like when you're traveling and acquiring a human language, there's a certain level of vocabulary that you need to achieve before you can do things like buy groceries and be able to like transact financial exchanges or, you know, have a conversation about the weather. What is that vocabulary? Like, what are the kind of the levels of vocabulary that you need to acquire to be operational in Haskell? Or in I would say even in functional programming, because now that I've been exposed to this, I see it in Clojure and I see it in, you know, I actually see people doing this in JavaScript and in Erlang and Elixir and what have you.
Yeah, I don't really know how to answer this question. how to buy groceries in Haskell.
Let me scale that down, because I had this horrible tendency to spend 5 minutes asking what I say is going to be a single question, but is actually like 30. Let's take down the scope. When you were learning this vocabulary, at what point did you feel like you were really gaining traction? What kind of, where you were really starting to connect the dots?
So for me, I think after I got through functor was when I felt like,
functor, and what comes before functor?
Monoid.
Monoid is before functor.
And so I think once you understand monoid and functor, then a lot of other concepts in Haskell will start falling into place, because applicatives, this is not obvious to everyone. But I think once you really understand monoid and once you really understand functor, then like applicatives are monoidal functors. And that's not obvious to everyone. Like I said, it's not obvious at first, certainly. And monads have characteristics of both monoid and functor as well. And then you start seeing there's all these other functors. There's profunctors and bifunctors. So I think once you really understand monoid and functor, a lot of the rest of Haskell starts falling into place. And then, you know, type classes like alternative. Alternative is another kind of monoid. So we have all these other names, but if you can see the general pattern of monoids and functors, I think to me anyway, a lot of it then just started falling into place. Like applicatives to me then seemed, I don't want to say obvious or simple, but and traverse is the same sort of thing. And so we have this other name for it, traversable. And I was like, why was this called traverse? You know, I don't understand this word at all. But once I saw the, you know, the type signature and what happens, like what the function traverse does, I was like, oh, okay, I see what's happening here. So for me, those were the two big hills. Once I got over monoid and functor and really understood them well, then a lot of other stuff just kind of fell into place for me.
Right.
This is really interesting. So how was a monoid explained to you when you were first starting to learn Haskell? And then now how do you explain what a monoid is to someone that's learning Haskell?
So when monoid was first explained to me, it was, you know, well, it's the pattern of there's addition and multiplication and list concatenation. And so we've generalized out that pattern. And that was really hard for me to understand at first, because those three things are not, list concatenation and addition are similar, right? But multiplication is different. And so I was like, what do these three things have in common, right? Well, what they have in common is that they take two values of a certain type and return another value of that type, right? And that's the type signature of the main function that's in the monoid type class. But that doesn't really tell you very much, right? A lot of functions could do that.
Right.
So,
right.
In theory, at least, right? So how you combine them is really what's interesting about monoids, right? And also what makes concatenation and addition different from multiplication. So fortunately, in college, I had a fair bit of exposure to Boolean algebra. And so figuring out that, like, oh, there's actually two basic genres or varieties of monoid, and they are disjunctive or additive, or they are conjunctive or multiplicative. And sort of figuring that out, then I was like, okay, so, like, to me, I always think that monoid should really be maybe two different type classes, one for, like, the additive monoids, so list concatenation and addition and things where you're, you know, sort of adding two things, like a set union, right? And then conjunctive, which would be like the set intersections or multiplication or cross products, right? And I always think those maybe should be two different type classes, but there's not a good way to do that really in Haskell. So instead we have this one type class, and then we do this ugly business of wrapping them in different type names.
Is that why you have things like, you'll have a constructor for sum? So it's just a, it's just a wrapper for an integer. You know, I don't know if that's so bad.
I don't like it, but
Well, you know what? You do it a lot more than I do. So I'm going to take your word for it.
Yeah. So yeah, that's exactly why sum and product are wrappers for integers, because integer doesn't have a monoid. It has two monoids over it. Right.
Right. I see.
So yeah.
There's lots of stuff you could do with there's lots of ways to combine integers.
Yeah. And those are, you know, the two basic ones. And then because monoids also have to have an identity, right? And so with semigroups, then you get even more semigroups for integers, right? Because you get max and min because they don't have an identity. So they're semigroups. Yeah. So sorry if I'm going.
Well, you know, so, but I think it is so yeah, you risk getting down into the weeds with the vocabulary, but, but I think that there's a message here. Cause when I, you know, your answer to the question is really, when I understood monoid and I understood functor, from that point on, the overhead that you had to expend to get other things was lower than the overhead that you had to expend to get those initial two things. Yes. And, you know, for anyone listening, monoid and functor are probably opaque terms. Like, you have no idea what the hell they mean. I mean, we've been talking about them and things like that a little bit, but that it's okay because they're a finite set of opaque terms and they're very achievable. And, like, once you can achieve those, then you can start combining, like, then you've done like 90% of the work and now you're just combining them into interesting and novel ways.
Yes. And I will say that a lot of people do tell us about Haskell book that applicative is actually the hardest chapter in the book, not monad, but applicative. And so for them, a lot of people do tell us that. For me, that was, well, because that's the first time that you've taken the concept of monoid and the concept of functor and, like, sort of combined them into a new thing. And so then once you've done that with applicative, then I think after that, really then it's all downhill.
Right. And so it seems like there's a, you know, a couple of key insights, right? Is that as you're climbing that hill, I like that analogy, is like, one, just understanding that there are things like type classes. So, you know, so through attacking monoid and through attacking functor, you realize, oh, there is such a thing. By recognizing there is such a thing as a functor, you kind of, you recognize that there is the potential for other type classes like it.
Right.
And then through combining it with monoid to get applicative, you can see, oh, well, then I can actually compose these things into new instances of those things. And then that's kind of, that's the, either the crest of the hill or Pandora's box, depending on which way you look at it. I think there's a hopeful message in there, and that, you know, yes, if you can invest the time to learn these opaque terms, it really is, and making them transparent to you, you can really, really, really lean heavily on that knowledge.
Yeah.
Going forward.
Yeah. You know, it's like I'm writing a new book now called The Joy of Haskell. The idea of The Joy of Haskell is kind of, we want to make, so it's written, I guess it's meant to be an intermediate book. So for people who already know some Haskell, but we want to make words like functor more general. Like in Haskell book, we really focused on the type class called functor when it's actually a concept from mathematics or actually originally from linguistics, oddly enough, but we really focused on the type class in there rather than trying to explain what functors are generally. So in the new book, in The Joy of Haskell, we're going to try to take a lot of these terms like monoids and functors and, you know, catamorphisms and all these other words that Haskellers use all the time and try to explain them generally, and then also give examples, like interesting uses from different libraries and stuff like that. So it will serve as both, hopefully, a guide to the vocabulary of the Haskell ecosystem and also like some, you know, sort of documentation and examples for libraries and things like that, that are useful. So because these things do have uses, they do get used in interesting and exciting or terrifying, you know, maybe those are related ways in. And so that's the goal of the new book, is to try to make a guide to all this vocabulary that Haskellers use all the time. So that's what we're trying to do. So how do I explain monoids now, he asked. You've got two values of whatever type. It doesn't matter the type, right? But we've got two values of them, and there are, in general, there will be two ways you can think of to combine them, either making just a sum or a union of all the values in them, or making some kind of product of those values, if they contain multiple values, or even if they only contain one, right? And so that's how I explain them now. So I'm not certain that addition and multiplication are actually the best ways to start with that, because addition and multiplication don't act quite like set, union, and intersection do. Mm-hmm. And so I think actually thinking of them in terms of, like, if you know anything about sets, so this is how I explain monoids to people now. If you know anything, if I start from set theory, and that sounds really heavy, but it doesn't have to be, because I think a lot of things about sets are,
they're very intuitive, especially if you have visuals.
Very intuitive for people to think about. Yes, exactly. And so,
especially with visuals, yeah.
Yes, yeah. And so I explain monoid now and more in terms of set, union, and intersection. And I'm actually giving a talk in October. Oh, it's coming up in just a couple of weeks. at Haskell Exchange is the October 12th and 13th in London, and I'm giving a talk there called A Monoid for All Seasons. And I'm going to try to explain the set theoretic motivation for monoids and try to explain them in those terms, and then talk about how, you know, alternative is also semi-group is a little bit different because it lacks the identity, but try to explain like the alternative type class and monad plus is really the same thing as alternative, as like, see, they're, you know, these things are also just monoids, right? And so we have this different name because it's a different type class, alternative, but it's really just another kind of monoid. So yeah, so I'm giving that talk about set theory and monoids in October in a couple weeks. So people keep asking me on Twitter, what's your obsession with monoids? Because my name on Twitter is Monoid Mary. And so people keep asking, what's your obsession with monoids? So I'm going to try to explain why I love them so much.
Well, I think it's an awesome point, which I've just gotten to experience, is once you kind of see, like, oh, there are these abstract things, you start searching for them.
Yep.
And a lot of times you'll uncover them and it'll be a real time saver. Even if you're, you know, there's the thrill of unearthing it in the first place. And then when you can say, oh, wow, now that I've identified this thing as a monoid, there's so much less that I have to write. Yeah. You know, there's like less work that I have to do. It's like it's the same reason that we write frameworks for ourselves in software. You know, it's like, you know, we love Ruby on Rails because of all the work we don't have to do. Now you have to expend a lot of energy to work with it, right? Using Rails as an example, but there's lots of software frameworks, right? And it's like, if you can find a good persistence framework, or you can find a good thing for making, you know, a library for handling HTTP requests and responses, why would you write it all by hand in the first place? And I think that's kind of the thing that's exciting for me as a developer, is being able to see, oh, wow, monoid is a thing. Functor is a thing. Yeah. And I can now actually use this, and I can use it almost as a looking glass to explore the world around me. And, you know, when I see something in the landscape that just leaps out through that lens. Lens is another great one that I've been on a big kick here lately. But being able to say, oh, wow, this is going to save me so much time because of the thoughts I don't have to think and the code that I don't have to write. So I think it's, you know, connecting it back to the pragmatic, I can see why you can become like, I certainly have become really, you know, obsessed, maybe not about monoids, but, you know, this having a type class loom large in your mind.
Yep. Yeah, I think it's a really powerful thing. Sometimes that jargon is really useful. It's useful in the sense that it like kind of compresses a bunch of information into a single word to remember, right? It's like when I was teaching my 8-year-old multiplication, right? And we were talking about how, oh, it's like addition in that it's, well, for us, we're adults, so I can just go ahead and say it's associative and commutative, right? But I was showing him that you can do those things and that addition is like that too. And we were talking about that and he was so excited to learn that there's this word commutative that encapsulates this idea for both concepts, right? So he doesn't have to mm-hmm. think like, oh, addition does this thing. Multiplication does this thing. He doesn't have to remember both of those things. It's like, he just remembers, ah, commutative. And they're both like this. And it kind of compresses that information then what you have to remember and think about. And then it does make it easier to see that pattern in other things, right? Then we can find commutativity in other things because now we have this pattern that we can look for and we've got a name for it. So we can talk about it. And really there's a lot of stuff like that in Haskell where we find some pattern that we find useful or we want to be able to talk about or easily translate to a bunch of different types, right? And I'm not sure translate's quite the right word, but you know what I mean, I think.
Uh-huh.
And so then we give it a name, right? And we make a type class for it. And it's like, oh, now we find it even more places.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah. Yep.
So it's cool. It's, yeah. it's about thinking less, right?
Yeah.
That's the big misconception is that it's not about thinking more. Right. It's about thinking less.
It really is. I think it's because there's so much kind of upfront work where you have to learn all this new stuff upfront, then people mistake that for how much work we're always doing. But in Haskell, it's like, well, we did all this work upfront and now we're not going to think about these things anymore.
Yep.
That sounds like a good title for a book, you know, learn Haskell and you will think less. Or think less, learn Haskell. But it's true. Like when I struggled through that online class, like I came out of that just being able to pick up any functional programming language and just, you know, hit the ground running.
Yeah.
So it's definitely a plus.
Yeah.
And you will think less.
Yeah. Yeah. In the long term, I think that you do. Yeah. Haskell's not a perfect language. You know, there are things that probably could be improved.
Now, before we go, I wanted to ask you, you know, having had this very unique on-ramp into programming, which apparently you're still not convinced about, I'm curious what it would take to actually convince you. But the real question that I have is there any advice that you have for someone who, you know, does not have a classical, I would say stereotypical background in programming, who may not think that they would find programming interesting, who might have any number of roadblocks or in terms of their own conceptions about the path forward, what advice would you have for them?
Well, I am a bit joking when I say that I'm still not sure about writing software. I don't feel like I'm good at it. And there are a bunch of domains that are, I think this is really the key. There are a bunch of domains in programming that I don't personally care about. I don't want to make web apps. And I have nothing but respect and admiration for people who do. I think it's very, to me, it's very, very hard. And so,
mostly because we don't have our tools are insane.
Well, yeah, and there's just so many things outside your programming, your own program. There are just so many things that you have to think about and deal with, right? Because there's the network and there's other people's computers and what they might be doing and other people's software and what it might be doing, and it's just. You know, it's insane. So for me, it's very hard. And so there's a lot of domains of programming that I don't care about. And I think that those are, when I thought about programming, that's the kind of thing I would think about. You know, I certainly knew a lot of people who were web developers or, the sort of common programming jobs, I guess. Some of them just weren't that appealing to me. And I still don't really like doing the kinds of, I'm not interested in making games or graphics. And so those were the kinds of things that I thought about for programming. So there are things, though, that I am interested in doing. Very interested in natural language processing. And I guess that's related to, you know, sort of machine learning. And I have found that I'm very interested in things like, like I've recently taken up an interest in things like the RAFT protocol, the consensus protocol. So those kinds of things interest me a lot. And there's a lot of there's a lot of the theory that interests me. Like I'm really interested in, I'm reading a dissertation right now about implementing a non-strict lambda calculus, right? Which is, it was sort of, that's what Haskell is, right? Is a non-strict lambda calculus. But this is this guy's dissertation, sort of theoretically implementing a non-strict lambda calculus. To me, that the theoretical side is really interesting. But then I am also interested in certain kinds of software. For some reason, I have developed quite an interest in making Twitter bots. but so there are some things. So I think that the advice I would give is just, I'm rambling a little bit, sorry, but I think the advice that I would give to people who think that they're not interested in programming, so why should they learn, whatever, is just find the thing that you are interested in. And there's probably a way you can make software for that. And maybe that will be the thing that will get you interested in it. And then it might not be Haskell. Maybe you are interested in making web apps, in which case, I mean, I would say go for Elm or PureScript, obviously, because I like functional programming, but but then, you know, Haskell might not be the best first language for you in that case, but find the thing that you're interested in, and there probably is a way to write software to do that. And so there's probably something in programming that will interest you. It's such a vast field.
All right. Well, I really, really like that answer.
Yeah, that's beautiful advice.
Yep.
Find your domain.
It's bigger than you think.
It's much bigger than you think.
And there is a place for you.
Yes.
Thank you so much for coming on the show, Julie. I really, really, really enjoyed our conversation.
Yeah, so did I. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you, Elric. Now, before we go, I understand that you are going to be in London on the, what is it, roughly very, very soon. You said you were giving a talk.
Yes, the 12th and 13th of October. Mm-hmm. It will be recorded for people who can't get to London. It will be recorded, I believe. So, yep.
All right. You're going to be talking on a monoid for all seasons.
Yes.
and then you've also got the Joy of Haskell book, which you're hacking away on
writing,
right now.
Yes. Yes.
All right. Well, with that, thank you so much for both of you. And thank you all for listening. What's a good place for people to reach out for you?
If they're on Twitter, I'm very active on Twitter. So I'm Argumentronic on Twitter. And my blog is also Argumentronic. So that has more contact information.
All right. Well, fantastic. We'll link to those in the show notes. And for everybody else, thank you for listening. You can get in contact with us at the Frontside on Twitter and contact at frontside.io over email. We'd love to hear from you. And this just in, we're running a special. If you go to our website and enter the promo code ELRIC20, you can get a 20% discount on your next custom developed web application. So go check that out. Take it easy, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.